Welcome back to the Smokescreen Podcast, episode 60. And then we're here again with another convicting a murderer slash making a murderer podcast. This thing just keeps on going.
Yes.
We're kind of riding the wave, honestly.
Yeah.
Not ashamed to say it, but you know, we keep getting reached out to. And this time we have another special guest. We were not expecting this.
Not at all.
But if you saw convicting a murderer, you saw a lady named Christine Franson, and she was featured throughout the documentary, I think from episode 2 on here and there, not all throughout too much airtime per episode, except for episode 10, she was featured a lot more. She was the one who was out in front picketing at the courthouse and all that stuff for Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey, and she would be questioned by, you know, so-called truthers. So-called guilters.
Yeah, guilters.
You get confused with these boxes. But she was confronted, and but she seemed to be the one to be open to have conversations with these people. And it turns out that after this whole process, you know, that they kind of documented a little bit in this docuseries, that she had changed her mind. So she was 100%, I mean, really deep.
Yeah.
A lot deeper than we thought. That was the big thing, right? We thought it was somebody like us who watched the documentary. She was just out there picketing. She believed in their innocence, all that stuff. But she has a good story.
She really does. And I don't know. I don't know how anybody who likes this stuff won't be interested to see how this story unfolds.
Exactly. So her major complaint with convicting a murderer was, and she understands, you know, and she's still friendly with everybody there. She was featured, but she was kind of disappointed that they cut out a lot of the stuff and how she got from her, like she said, A to B, you know, from believing in his innocence or their innocence to believing they're guilty and all this kind of stuff, and how she got there, what her, you know, thought process was. And this was over a long period of time, and it was an outstanding conversation. And I really thank her for contacting us, and she wanted to do one podcast, so kind of exclusive. That feels pretty good. We appreciate the compliment. So she's going just to point people to this podcast and say, look, you want to know why I left? Here's my story.
That's right.
So very honored to have Christine on, and we just got done an outstanding conversation. Again, a lot deeper than we thought. She was embedded, I would say.
Embedded is a good way
to put it. With the Innocence team.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get right to it. Christine Franson in Convicting a Murderer.
I want you to put your hands together.
The neighborhood.
And welcome to the stage. Big round of applause.
Christine, thank you for joining us. Christine Franson, everybody, joining us from Convicting a Murderer. This has been a hot topic the last few weeks, obviously. We kind of ended up in a shitstorm ourselves.
Man, yeah.
Just for having maybe a change of opinion on some things. So, Christine, you were an Avery supporter. You watched, I guess, you're going to give us all the details on this, but just in a nutshell, you believed he is innocent as making a murderer presented. And then you were out there picketing, all that kind of stuff in Wisconsin. You had in the docuseries Convicting a Murderer, which we just had Brenda on last week. You had people speaking to you, and you seemed like you were at least receptive to hearing some other ideas or alternative theories or whatever it may be, because a lot of people don't really seem to be receptive to anything regarding a different opinion. So then you said you got interviewed throughout the series and they cut a lot out. And so in the end, in episode 10, we just saw this week, you had converted and contacted her back to get, I guess, to clarify your position. So you wanted to tell your story, but essentially how you got from believing he was innocent to obviously being now not a supporter, but thinking he's guilty.
Right. So do you want the whole story?
Go for it. I mean, this is your...
It's a little bit of a ride. So I watched it over the holiday break, just like everybody else who jumped on that bandwagon right away. I tend to stay away from things that have a lot of hype and wait for the hype to die down before I watch it. Like Game of Thrones, I didn't start that until like season 6. I mean, I just can't tend to avoid things.
Right.
I had my family hounding me, and my sister in particular, and like everybody who's on vacation had, you know, little or nothing to do. I was actually up in Lutzen, Minnesota with my sister and her family. Started it not even really knowing what it was. I thought it was going to be, since it was a 10-part series, I thought they were going to feature each episode a person who was wrongfully convicted and prison turned them into a murderer.
Right.
And so as soon as I watched the first episode and they ended with that whole, is Stephen Avery in custody?
Right.
I was like, oh no, this is a whole thing. This is like one person's story. And so I was pretty hooked pretty quickly.
Yeah, that was a big hook. We said that immediately. We both then went, oh shit.
Yeah, well, this is going to be good, right? But I'm one of those people that I mean, I immediately picked up my phone. Are they still in prison? Oh, yep, they're still in prison. So I got to figure out what went wrong.
Right.
And so we binged most of it on December 30th. We finished the last couple of episodes, I think, on the 31st, New Year's Eve, just before a long trip back home. My sister kept saying, wait until episode 4. And sure enough, episode 4 is Brendan's interrogation. And at the time, I had a 14-year-old son who's on the spectrum, very high functioning, very intelligent. Right. But very minimal coping skills. And I could imagine him being pulled out of school to talk to police officers about something somebody else had done and being roped into saying he was involved in some capacity.
Yes.
And it immediately pulled at my heartstrings. I'm a pretty emotional person, but I'm also able to compartmentalize pretty well. And so it was probably the first time I'd watched any docuseries or documentary. And arguably Making a Murder was like the docuseries. I mean, there were before that, but this was the catalyst to just so many more. And so I got very emotionally involved early on and immediately started researching while watching. I was digging up information and consuming what I was seeing, but I was also jotting down information and taking mental notes of what I was reading. On the trip home, there was a blizzard. So it was like a 13-hour drive home. And I was just consuming every single bit of information I could get. And I had entered into the family's Facebook group, which was only like 2,000 people at the time.
You're saying the Avery family's?
Yep.
Okay.
In the Avery family's Facebook group, one of the people said that they needed admins. They were having a difficult time keeping up with member requests and filtering out spam. And I had run a small coupon group. I used to be an extreme couponer, if you can imagine that.
And my ex-wife.
Somebody.
I had the binders with all the coupons. Would leave with $300 worth of stuff for $15.
Right.
Anyway, I was like, well, I got a little bit of experience admitting groups. You know, if you want me to help, I sure can. And so I think that was like by January 2nd. So just in a couple of days later, I was admitting the Avery Dassey family Facebook group.
Wow.
No, so you got in pretty deep, pretty quick.
Really fast. So I was researching information and like everybody else was throwing out theories left and right. I had stumbled on a blog by a convoluted Brian that was written in 2009 about a woman in Maribel nearby, near Manitowoc. Her ex-husband, who was a German, and he was just referred to as the German. I don't know if you've ever heard the German theory. But she talked about how she thought her husband could have been responsible for Teresa's murder. Wow. And the information was compelling. There were police reports, and I'll get to that in a little bit, but there were other pieces of information that put him behaving irrationally during the same time, starting the day that Teresa went missing, up until he was arrested the day the vehicle was found. And so I was in the Facebook group commenting about it, sharing the blog with people, discussing the theory, trying to figure out who the German was. And this blatantly fake Facebook profile was kind of following me in the group, like liking this comment. And, you know, the name was Von Friedental, which sounded pretty German to me. And so I sent them a private message. Actually, I didn't send a private message. I commented on one of the posts and I said, hey, Vaughn, send me a PM. And what happened after that was completely unexpected. She sent me a message. She said, I am who you think I am. I'm pretty convinced my husband killed Teresa, or my ex-husband killed Teresa. What do you want to know?
Wow.
she had been compiling for years information that connected her husband to that situation, including burning things on their property, her dogs finding bones in the yard, him finding pornographic material at his home. She found unexplained women's undergarment that fit around the same size that Teresa would have been. And it led to his arrest for behaving irrationally on November 5th, the day they found the vehicle. But the police wouldn't work with her after that. They wouldn't tell her.
Just to be clear, this woman's husband was arrested the same day.
This woman's ex-husband. And he was yelling at them in German, "I'll never tell. I'll never tell." You know, and a couple of other very, you know, shady things. He was arrested. And then previous to that, actually, he'd been out with his wife and saw a poster of Teresa. And they were looking at the poster and he claimed to her, "Oh, yeah, she's already dead," and was dismissive about it. And that was one of the things that made her think, you know, that he could have been involved. Anyway, he was arrested. And after that, the police wouldn't work with her regarding her theory that he could have been involved, or information regarding extraditing him back to Germany because his visa had expired. And in fact, they actually put him up in an apartment and paid for his groceries and paid for his clothing and seemingly covered up any communication they had with him. And she never knew whether they discussed with him the possibility of him being involved in Teresa's murder. And anytime she would try to talk to them about it, and she actually brought the women's clothes to the police department, she was brushed off. And so all of that at the height of my emotional involvement in all of this seemed pretty compelling. And so she sent me the police report. She sent me his picture. Obviously I knew his real name by that time. She had like a detailed chronological order of all of these things that happened during that week. And so January 6th is when, Kathleen Zellner officially announced that she was taking the case.
Right.
And so I sent an email. I just compiled it all up, every message that I'd had with this woman, and all of the pieces of evidence that she sent me. And then I got a call from Kathleen on January 12th. And we spent 2 hours on the phone talking about all of it. And EDTA and all the scientific evidence that was going to free Stephen, quote unquote, she said, "We're going to go in like a SWAT team after the science comes back and take him out. This isn't going to take as long as like the Ryan Ferguson case.
Right.
This is going to be cut and dry." And so from then, I was working with her investigator and this woman to compile an affidavit as the alternate suspect. Within, I don't know, about a month, the lady backed down. She said she sent us these crazy emails saying we were trying to get her killed. Her husband's going to come after her. She doesn't want any involvement anymore. And from then, Kathleen asked me to stay admitting in the group and continue giving her information. And so I did that for a couple of years, communicating back and forth with Kathleen, giving her every piece of information that I could, and her sharing information with me. And so when I say I was in it, I was like in it.
Yeah, you were in it, in it.
Not just your typical supporter. I mean, I was,
right.
I was in it, which makes my acknowledging that I was wrong even more difficult, honestly.
Sure.
I wasn't just your typical supporter. I mean, I was, you know, I had a Twitter following. I had like Alec Baldwin and Rosie O'Donnell and a variety of people following me on Twitter, and having 3 a.m. conversations with Rosie about the Avery family. And I mean, it was far, far too deep.
No, that's good. Good context.
Go ahead. All the, like the truther community will recognize your name.
The core group of them. Absolutely.
And they're the ones that are the most disappointed in you.
Because
y'all go way back. I can imagine.
It got ugly back then, honestly. I mean, there was like truthers versus guilters, but there was also like an a truthers versus truthers, like infighting thing going on. And
right.
there was a lot of drama back then. Sometimes embarrassed that I was even involved in some of it. I wasn't, you know, involved in it to the capacity that some were. I mean, there was a lot of insulting and fighting and things like that. And I was pretty content to ignore all of that stuff. I certainly got my fair share of assaults from those people. But I was on a mission. My mission was to reform juvenile interrogation. That was right. all I cared about. It was pretty clear early on that Stephen was a, can I swear? I'm a swear.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
It was pretty, it was apparent pretty early on that Stephen Avery was a piece of shit.
Yes.
And so I guess my involvement in trying to help Stephen was because the end game would be helping Brendan.
Sure.
But I was very much invested in reform. I didn't understand how on four separate occasions a intellectually challenged teenager could be interrogated without representation. I have a bit of a different view on that. I still think that there's need for reform, but I have a better understanding of it now. I had an interview with Fassbender that was cut from this documentary that I'm very appreciative because he helped me understand where they were coming from. So I still support Brendan, but in a different capacity. But yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what we talk about all the time on the podcast and just offline chatting mm-hmm. about doing these podcasts is Brendan's he's the anomaly in this thing. I think a lot of people like myself, I think that, you know, Stephen probably did it somehow or another, whether it's how, again, the case, you know, presented, it's a whole different story, but you know, Brendan, he's this sympathetic character, and he is, regardless of his involvement. I mean, he got roped into this, it seems to me. And so I think that's where everybody's a little more touchy, I would say, on this whole thing.
Yeah, he's Stephen, such a sympathetic
character. Probably, maybe, whatever. But Brendan, nah, there's no way.
So you both are still pretty much like on the fence, like leaning mm-hmm. guilty, but kind of still on the fence?
I think I'm still... I think I lean more towards they didn't do it.
Okay.
He's been on a pretty big roller coaster about this.
It's just my gut feeling. There's something off about it. Cause after watching, Convicting a Murderer, I'm floored with the way I was misled, right, by things. But the foundation of the way it all went down, like I actually literally right before we came on with you, I told Chris, I said, I can still see, like, if I was on the jury, how I could come back with a guilty verdict for Stephen simply because of the blood in the raft. But if somebody could ever show me how that could have been planted, then, cause I think that really links everything else together.
Yeah, in a logical way, planning in a logical way and not from a sink, mm-hmm. you're saying.
Yep. Yes. And so, because, you know, I believe me, I don't have some grand theory about I know who did it or anything. I feel like I'm a pretty, you know, obviously I wasn't on the jury, but I feel like just from watching how he reacts to things, he comes across as an innocent guy. And I'm talking about Stephen.
Right.
Seriously, my gut tells me he's sincere when he's telling them, you know, go search it. I don't care. You're not going to find anything. I didn't do anything. And his interactions with Barb on those phone calls, he's like, I'm sorry your son told all this stuff. You know what I mean? But dude, they got to him. You know, you should have been there with him. I don't know.
Because I felt the exact same way. I mean, I did. But I have listened to those phone calls. You got to listen to the really, really, really early stuff, like the early statements, right. the early phone calls, because that's where you're going to get the rawest stuff. And if you listen to those phone calls, especially in chronological order,
mm-hmm.
Stephen is really good at manipulating his family. He is mm-hmm. genuine. He is charming. But he's a master manipulator. So let's take the garage for the incident, or for instance, the blood in the garage. Okay. First, it started off as some sort of fluids, right? Well, you can dismiss right. the fact that it was fluids and it was definitely blood, because in the history of history, nobody has ever used gasoline, paint thinner, and then what else did they use? Gasoline, paint thinner, bleach to clean up car fluids, and only in one tiny section of the garage when the entire garage is filled with car fluids. So
right, I agree with that.
Right. Let me say something really quick, if you don't mind. I was just having this conversation on Twitter, and this is the kind of stuff that I was trying to. The bigger point was that you have these official documents where people have their, you know, whether they're experts or not, they'll say, in my opinion, you know, this is this or whatever. But and people will take that as the gospel. It's still an opinion, and you have to piece together all these opinions, even though it's an official piece of paper. I was saying the conversation was, okay, Brendan came home with jeans that night with bleach on them, but because there was no hemoglobin or something else on the jeans that he washed that night, by the way, they're no longer relevant because some expert of the state said that it didn't glow quite right and it wasn't consistent with bleach and then, you know, maybe using another chemical or something. But it's like, so you're going to throw out the gene evidence because it doesn't have blood on it. And somebody's opinion on an official piece of paper is part of the whole court process and the transcripts and all that stuff. Now we can just ignore the genes. Is that logical to anyone, really? No. I mean, no.
No, but if you listen to those early phone calls, this is what Steven does. He's really good at doing this. So he just miraculously comes up with an idea, and then he pitches it to every person he talks to until it sticks on somebody. And one of the things was, well, okay, it wasn't car fluids, it was blood, but it was because I had that deer. Do you remember that deer I had in the garage? And he will pitch that to one person after another, and you can see him, hear him methodically doing it until it sticks. And somebody's like, oh yeah, I remember that deer. And then every conversation he has after that, and he's like, well, yeah, there was that deer in there because this guy remembers it. And he does that with so many different pieces. And if you see that pattern, it's really hard to ignore. And he does it with every single thing that he just suddenly miraculously remembers. But here's a bombshell for you. So we're talking about these jeans, right? And the bleach in the jeans, but nobody ever talks about Brendan's shoes. So if you look in Brendan's case file and look at the evidence picture, there's a picture of those old shoes, the red ones that he was talking about that he wore. He thought they were starters or something like that. And he tells people and I can't remember which, you'll have to excuse me because I've been so twice removed from looking at the information since I finished wrapping up with convicting 3 years ago. But in one of the interviews, he talks about not wanting to touch it and using his feet to clean up the blood, like move the rag around and clean the blood up, right? You take a look at those evidence photos. His right shoe is significantly bright. It's clean in comparison to the other shoe because he used his right foot to use the rags to wipe up, you know, the blood down there. And you never hear about that. After you're done here, go take a look at the picture of the shoes. I have it on my phone, actually. But Brendan, or Brendan.
Maybe you can insert that there.
I was going to say, just really quick, do you have that? Can you send that to me? You don't have to do it now, but afterwards, I'll stick it in the podcast. Where do we hear that information?
Yeah.
Anywhere? He's done that so many times in those phone calls. You know, he doesn't remember a fire. Oh, it wasn't on Monday. It was a week before. It was 2 weeks before. It was, you know, he can't remember. And then suddenly when he does remember, he remembers, well, okay, if I did have a fire, Brendan was there.
Yeah, that was the Barb conversation. There was no fire until Barb. We said this last week. Barb all of a sudden, no, it was that night I went to see Scott's mom in the hospital. Well, then Brendan was with me.
Right. And that was manipulative as hell. If you listen to it, I mean, he threw that in there because that would change her mind about saying that there was a fire that night. Because,
absolutely.
You know, Brendan was there. Just watch what you're saying because
he said this last week, a little, kind of wink.
Yeah. That's what it felt like.
Yep.
But then miraculously he doesn't remember at all for the longest time having a fire. But now he's nailed with having a fire, right?
Right.
And he remembers every single detail about the fire. He remembers what he put in there, when he put in there, what he was doing, you know. And so he's pretty selective about what he remembers and what he doesn't. But he was going to sell that I didn't have a fire thing until somebody said I have a fire. I had a fire. And suddenly he's got the memory of an elephant.
Right.
And so if you listen to those really early jail calls and those really early statements, you see these nuggets of things. And I equate it to, okay, I don't know how old you guys are, but you remember the 90s 3D?
Yes.
Pictures where you had to stare at them crooked, like in Mall Rats, that guy staring at you can't find the schooner. you know, and you can stare at it forever, but if you look at it just right, every single time you go back to look at it again, it pops up with no problem. That's what this case is for me. And so I'm just kind of waiting for people to see the 3D image, because after you've seen it, there's no way on earth anybody can ever convince me that he's innocent again.
Yeah. I mean, so real quick,
somebody could come forward and say they did it, and I would still probably be in disbelief.
Right. But, so back then, you know, because we just watched the thing, and we, you know, again, back in the day, we did a podcast 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. We watched it because he had seen it first, and I think you turned me on to it, and I was instantly hooked and did the podcast, all that stuff. But we were more like just, you know, he's a true crime nut, and I am too to some degree, but he's way more in depth in true crime. So we just did it as, this is interesting, we're going to talk about it, but we didn't dive in and go search for documents and
never.
You know, and I understand how people do so.
And I was obsessed with it, but it stayed with I was obsessed with the actual docuseries.
Right, right. And that was back then. Of course, more recently, we've got into more looking into the evidence and documents more detailed. We've never claimed to be case experts. That's why we have people like you and had Brenda last week. I mean, we were generally interested in it. So what was your mindset back then, though, if you were, you know, just to kind of get your perspective, if you were already kind of that deep into it as a believer or a supporter of him, and then did somebody back in those days come across and say, what about this, what about that, did you just kind of blow it off, or did you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
I was one of the few people that wanted as much information as possible, and so I was already talking to guilters, I was already listening to, I was already respecting opinion, I was already, you know, I'm never one that's going to shut out information. If you're going to have an opinion about something, the only way it's credible is if you're willing to look at all of it.
Right, exactly.
So I was looking at all of it, but I had a set of filters that the average bear didn't have. I was already friends with Stephen Drizin and communicating with him on Facebook and working with Kathleen Zellner and admitting the Facebook family page, where it was literally my job to shut out any indication that anybody in the family could be guilty. I mean, it was my job to block those people, to, you know, delete posts, to approve posts. And so while I was consuming all of the information as much as possible, I was also shutting out a lot inadvertently, something I probably never would have done in any other situation. But in this particular case, I was very much driven by emotion. I was not a logical human being. And it took me a long time to see that. I had to step away from it, honestly, for a while.
A bit.
In order to go back down through the case. And so when I met with Brenda, and you'll see Megan and I sitting with her talking in Minneapolis, I probably should go further back than that. I was interviewed at the rally in 2018. By what I thought was a college documentary team who wanted to do a documentary on the response to Making a Murderer over social media and gender. And I mean, at that time, and I had already experienced so much on social media regarding this case that I thought you could do an entire documentary on that alone.
Right.
And so I was all for it. It wasn't until later that I discovered that it was convicting a murderer. And at that time, when people started talking about convicting a murderer, it was Kratz's documentary. Everybody said it was going to be all Kratz, all, you know, the whole thing was driven by Kratz, and it was going to be a bunch of garbage. And I didn't really know what to expect. And so I did some research and found out who was behind it. And I reached out to Sean Reck, and I said, hey, I'm still kind of in this, and I need you to pull my footage. And so that kind of sparked a friendship between he and I. We talked about all kinds of things. I took a look at his previous documentaries, which are brilliant.
Right. Oh, yes.
I discovered that my son, I told him the reason I got involved is because he's on the spectrum, and he also shared with me that he's on the spectrum, similar issues that Jet had. And I know my son pretty well, and I know the autistic community pretty well through the years trying to advocate for my son. And I couldn't see somebody with any spectrum traits at all doing anything unfairly, because it's just not how their minds work.
Right.
And so I gave him the benefit of the doubt that he was trying to create a fair documentary. I just didn't know where I wanted to be in that.
So you were asking him to pull your footage for being a truther?
For a couple different reasons. I didn't want to have any involvement in it because I was still pretty in it, and I thought that would make me look bad. And I didn't want to disappoint people. And because I was already on the fence. I was already leaning a little bit. I had already pretty much decided that Steven was a garbage human being, and I was focusing mostly on Brendan. But I didn't want to tell the world that I thought Steven was a garbage human being, because that in my mind would have hurt Brendan. Because if Steven did it, then Brendan was probably involved in some capacity. And so I had to hold on to the fact that Steven didn't in order to help Brendan. And so when I asked him to pull the footage, he talked me into keeping it. And I said, well, if you're going to keep it, then I'd like to follow up. I wanted to know what they had, honestly, I was already on the fence, and I wanted to know what they had. So I agreed to this Minneapolis meeting with Megan. And they asked me straight up, Brenda asked me, so what would it take? Cause I think she could probably see that I was working things out in my head. So what would it take? What one piece of information could we give you that would show, make you lean a little bit more guilty? I said, I wanted to see those pictures in the fire pit. I couldn't understand why there were no pictures taken, especially on the 8th when they discovered it. They made no qualms about taking a picture of the key the second they found it before they even touched it.
Yeah, right.
But human remains, they didn't.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah, until 2 days later after the bad weather on the 9th and then the 10th, they finally took the pictures, right?
Right. I mean, yes, it was a disturbed scene. Yes, they probably couldn't have made any sense of it in photos. Yes, there was no way for them to know for sure whether it was human remains right away, but take the damn picture.
Yep, makes no sense.
If you find something you suspect is a human being, you take the picture. And let the people, the experts, sort that shit out later on.
Yes.
And so I had a big problem with that. That and in the transcripts, when they talk about embedded bone in tire wire, that's a really hard thing for one to imagine. You can't visualize what that would look like, because in my mind, we're talking about loose wire. You know, if there were bones in it, how could they be embedded? Most people don't know that when a tire burns like that, it's not just loose wire. I mean, it's like a Brillo pad. It's like, it's very tight, tight wire. And so she showed me the pictures, and it wasn't just the few that they showed on convicting. It was a whole slew of pictures. I almost wish that they would have caught my face the moment she showed them to me, because you could probably see the moment I changed my mind. That's what I asked for. I wanted to see, there's no way to argue that whatsoever. Nobody planted bones if they're embedded in tires that were burned in that fire pit. But the first thing I did was I reached out to a famous mortician friend, and I'm not going to mention who she is, but a famous mortician friend of mine, because not a lot of people know this. I was actually going to go to mortuary school. And I ended up owning a dog kennel and being a professional dog groomer. So, I mean, riddle me that.
That's a big switch.
That's a big bit of a shift. But yeah, I was gonna move to Utah. I was gonna do my 2-year degree there, two year internship here. And I had become friends with this famous mortician. It feels weird to say those two words together, but yes, famous mortician. And used to work at a crematorium.
Wow.
And so the first thing I did was reach out to this person and ask them. So when a fire reaches a certain temperature, the bone becomes calcined, which means that there are no pores in it. It's not porous at all. It is glossy and small and reduced to fragments like grains of sand. But when a temp isn't maximum, to achieve that, it becomes these little spongy pieces of bone that have several porous holes in them. And if you look it up, you can actually see pictures. I have a link actually that I can show you, pictures of bone before it reaches the calcination, if that's a word, point. And it looks identical. I started researching all kinds of burnt human remains. Right. I was sifting through tons of pictures, and they were literally identical to what I saw in those tire treads.
So was that your moment? I mean, you said you had already kind of leaned in and suspecting some things, but that was the big turning point for you?
You know, that was probably the moment. Going back through the jail calls too, I had skimmed over the jail calls because you deserve a gold medal if you can make it through all the Avery phone calls. Right. And I had done it twice. And there's only so much, you can listen to before you start actually literally feeling crazy. But I did it the first time I did it as a supporter looking for
people. I'm so sorry.
It's awful.
We say this all the time.
If you want to torture somebody or get information out of them, I mean, you don't need to get a coerced confession. All you have to do is make them listen to the Avery jail. Yes. I'm like, no, please, no more.
He likens it to the I am Groot.
It is. It's like a language.
They can have a whole conversation with just
And it is almost like a language in itself. But I listened to it the first go around when they came out because I was interested, but I glossed over them. I mean, I'd already made up my mind, right? That's
right.
Same when it came to Ken Gratz's book and Indefensible by Michael Grisbach, and I read them. But did I really let any of that in or really take it to heart? No, not really.
Well, so, I was going to say, I've seen a lot of people on YouTube and then comments everywhere on the videos that we do, the podcasts and you know, Twitter especially, is they've watched this thing as far as convicting a murder. They've read all these other books, but I'm like, they don't have a single question, not one.
Yeah.
Not one.
It's wild.
It's not one doubt at all. I've never seen any of those people admit to saying, but this was at least, you know, interesting here, this part, or whatever.
Or this made me scratch my head. No, not at all.
Not a thing.
Nobody likes to acknowledge that they're wrong. Nobody likes to, you know, question themselves. They live in
echo. It's very odd. So what are you going to say, just to, real quick, to follow up on that? You know, when this comes out, you're going to be a liar like Brenda's a liar. Brenda's a liar. She lied to us the whole time, and then we pervade those lies. Right. Yeah. What do you say to that? Because you're just going to be lying because there was no shoe evidence. There was no shoe evidence or gene evidence. That doesn't count because this other guy said on a piece of paper that his opinion was that it didn't line up with, you know, whatever the case may be, whatever piece of evidence you want to talk about. But
I don't care anymore. I've become pretty resilient. I just shut that stuff out right away. Okay. So in the phone calls, you know, we talked about the patterns that I started seeing. But one of the things that got me the most is, okay, so there's a November 15th phone call where he's on the phone with Dolores. Dolores picks up another line because she's on, you know, Barb is calling her. Barb tells her that she's on her way to the police station. And out of the blue, Steven says, well, don't take Brendan. And I thought, okay, well, this is November 15th. He says, don't take Brendan. They've already spoken to him. You're going to get him all hooked up in this and you're going to lose a kid over it.
Wow.
That's November 15th, mind you, where Brendan has already only had just the one conversation with them in Steven's car.
Wow.
Yeah, that's you. What was that? The phone call you said, what date
November
was that?
November 15th. And so that hit me like a ton of bricks. And then after Brendan confesses, now, okay, if I'm an innocent man and her bones are found on my property and her car is found on my property and somebody confesses to being involved in it and says I'm involved in it too, my first response if I'm an innocent person is like, oh my God, this kid did it. He's trying to rope me into it too, but he must have killed this poor girl. Not once does he do that, unless it's to manipulate Brendan or manipulate Barb, which he does once. He goes, well, then Brendan must have done it. That's the only time he ever says it. He never uses it as a defense.
Right.
He never talks to his attorney about it. He has thrown every single Avery member under the bus.
Right. I was going to say that he's blamed his brothers.
But not the kid who confessed.
That's an excellent point.
That's a great point.
And so that struck me as odd. I mean, because if somebody said they did something and I was involved in it, my first response, if I knew nothing about it and if I was an innocent person, would be, I had nothing to do with it. But if that kid did it, then, you know, and that never happened. Along with many other things. And so as soon as my brain started flipping, I knew I needed to go through it all over again. And that was a painstaking decision because I'd already invested so much time and so many hours, but I needed to take the filters off and look at it again. And so I called Sean up and I said, look, I have two choices here. You're going to pull all my footage now.
Right.
Or because I have changed my mind or I'm leaning towards changing my mind, I have an obligation to follow through so that people can see my journey and possibly give them permission to acknowledge that they were wrong too. And I'm pretty sure I heard an audible gasp like from him, like, you let us do that. And it was not an easy choice. It was very much a grieving process for me because I had to let go of my beliefs. I had to step out of my echo chamber and take in the fact that, you know, not only did they do this, but I had to start looking at Teresa differently. This was about Brendan and Steven for me for so long that I never let what happened to this poor girl in. And that was a really hard time. So the people can come back at me all they want, but this was very hard for me. It was hard for my family. It was, but I felt like I owed it to Teresa, to the people that we harshly judged based on a documentary and literally destroyed their lives and, you know, in various capacities, and to uphold the integrity of documentaries in general. Like, we should be able to trust what we see on TV. We should be able to trust that the story we're being told is truthful.
When it's labeled a documentary, you should absolutely. I mean, it's like, when you think of documentaries, you think of, I don't know, Animal Kingdom, and it's just telling you how animals live their lives. It's not a story to it. I mean, there's cool stories and how they, you know, live their lives and hunt and whatever, but it's factual. There's no bias. But that's what we were saying before is, and I'm sorry to, I don't mean to butt in or anything. I want you to just tell your story, but it's just, you know, as we've seen the last couple of weeks, you know, the replies and the comments and whatever. And again, we don't care. It's just, it's halfway entertaining, honestly. But there's nuance in everything. There's not just black and white. And these people seem to take this hard line. And I think it's really important that whether you agree or not, whoever is out there listening, as far as guilt or innocence or anything, but if you can, you know, step back and you see one thing that you're questioning, I think it's powerful and that you can look back and say, wait a minute, what else are they lying about? You know, what else what else was I denying in a sense, even if I was told about it? Because I mean, this has been an everyday thing since we started doing these.
One thing that really bothers me too is now everybody is like, oh, we've always, everybody knows that documentaries aren't, you know, they pushing a narrative and everything. Well, if everybody knows that, why did everybody get so bent out of shape about making a murderer?
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Like, exactly.
And now that convicting a murderer is pointing out all the deceptive tactics they used, now they're like, everybody knew that to begin with. I'm not basing the way I feel about Steven or Brendan from anything to do with making a murderer anyway. I can't believe I hear
people
saying that.
We didn't need to see
that.
We knew all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we knew everything. No, you didn't.
I heard a guy say none of my opinions on their innocence comes from making a murderer. And I'm like, are you kidding me?
It's impossible.
My heart breaks for people like Fassbender. And I just sent him a message yesterday, actually, just kind of, I don't know, a little bit of closure. I mean, we had a really great interview in Wisconsin. We talked about a lot of stuff. I asked him a lot of hard questions too. I mean, because I still have some issues regarding Brendan's confession, and I still have.
I do too. I just said it tonight to Chris. Yep. Fassbender was
he acknowledges it, but I also have a better understanding of how difficult it must have been. This kid sent them on goose chases. Like he just kept shifting back and forth. And after a while, I mean, you got to be frustrated. Imagine trying to talk to your 3-year-old about who spilled the something in the house and trying to get a straight story out of him, you know. And
right.
You've been there as parents, right? And you're like, just tell me what happened, you know, for crying out loud, you know. Just tell me the truth. And repeatedly they would tell him, okay, that's a lie. Please stop telling us lies. We just want the truth, you know? Or why did you tell us that if you didn't do that? You know, I've had conversations like that with my smaller children. And so I can understand how frustrating it was for them. I think they were a little bit out of their element based on his intellectual capacity, which, by the way, Brendan is not nearly as intellectually impaired as they allowed to believe. I've spoken to him a couple of times. I've never written either one of them. I was never that person. I will never be that person.
Right.
But you know, there were times when the phone would get passed around, when they'd have Steven on the line, I'd be like, yeah, no thanks. but when they have Brendan on the line, I talked to him briefly. I've actually seen behind the scenes letters that he's written his mother, letters he's written Carla, very intelligent letters. Punctuation in the right place, all of the correct spelling, the use of larger words and vocabulary. I mean, these are not letters written by somebody who doesn't know what they're doing.
Well, now you're the second person in the 2 weeks to say this, and yeah. Now you're saying there's documentation to back that up, right? Because you
I have a letter that
you gotta have documentation.
I'll send you a letter he wrote, Carla. It was posted online, so I'm comfortable sending it to you. It's a very articulate letter. You know, he and our Carla and Barb were fighting at one point in time over something, probably money. It was money. Absolutely. And he wrote Carla a very long, detailed, heated letter about it was a very well written letter. I don't think my 17-year-old probably could write as good a letter.
Interesting.
So that misconception has always bothered me because it was one of the things that obviously roped me in. Anyway, I was on it. I keep getting lost in my tangent here. But I can send you that letter if you'd like. It was already posted publicly, I believe, somewhere. So I'm comfortable sending
it. Sure. Yeah. Because last week, Brenda sent a few documents afterward. We didn't even think, I usually don't edit anything, but for these, you know, if we're having specific conversations, I'll throw them in there for sure.
But I remember what I was getting at now, the interrogations. And so I can understand how frustrating it was for them and how they had to go to desperate tactics towards the end. Like, I can't even deal with Brendan's confessions anymore. I've read them repeatedly. I've watched them repeatedly. And it does remind me of trying to get information out of my kid who doesn't want to get in trouble. And here's what I take from it now after the 3D image pops up. Some of it is absolute garbage. Some of it is bullshit. Both Fassbender and I, and a couple of other people that I've spoken to, and I've spoken to everybody pretty much in this case. I've had interesting conversations, emails with Andy, and I've had conversations with Michael Grisbach. And the consensus is there's something that Brendan has not told us that's huge. And I don't know what it is. And some of the things he said was a deflection from that. I believe something happened in the garage. I don't know whether it was Brendan who pulled the trigger. Something happened that he's not willing to talk about. There are certain parts of his confession where he just clams up. And a lot of those are focused on what happened in the garage. And I think some of the other stuff is a deflection from that, or we'll never really know unless the kid tells the truth. And I don't even what is puzzled by it all said in the documentary. I don't even know if Brendan knows the truth anymore. Somewhere in all of that is the truth. But there's a lot of crap too. And I think Fassbender and I think when we had our interview, he agrees that, but I also understand that it was really hard for him to get that information, whatever information he could. Nobody wanted Brendan to be involved. None of them. I mean, that's why he was offered a plea deal. That's why.
Right.
They called Scott to a lunch one day to beg Scott to talk to Barb and say, hey, because nobody in the family was giving Brendan sound advice. And they thought if we can talk to Scott and Scott can talk to Barb, maybe we can get them to see reason and get Brendan to take a plea deal.
Right.
Likewise, they didn't want Avery to be involved in this case at all, which is why they handled it. Everybody will say that they targeted Avery. But if this were any other case, That trailer would have been ripped up and fully searched in the first day. Nobody really wanted it to be Avery at all because of his previous wrongful conviction, because there was a lawsuit against. They wanted to handle it with kid gloves, which is why these seven searches, which were never searches, they went in and grabbed one piece and then they left, and they went in and grabbed another piece. And that's why when the dog hit in the fire pit, they didn't push it right away. If this had been anybody else, they would have torn that whole thing apart. That whole trailer would have been torn apart in one day.
Yeah, that was some of the big revelations. And I think convicting a murder was, you know, and I think some people probably knew that from stuff before as far as testimony or case files is, you know, you keep hearing the seven searches, but it was really one, maybe two, but other ones were targeted, as they say. So they, you know, go get the gun, go get this, go get that. So
no, go get the vacuum cleaners, go get the computer, go get everything. They were literally in there to get one item and left. And if things were planted in that trailer, it would be pretty stupid to plant and then send the Manitowoc officers in to find it.
I mean, yeah, on one hand, you got the I think it was the county director or whatever saying no, as Brenda said, made clear elected officials. But then they could, I guess the deputies or whatever being trained evidence handlers could go with an escort essentially from the other county. But right. Yeah, why go in there and plant it? Not the next, you don't even know you're going back. Why, we said that before, they're going in the first time. They don't know they're going back. So why not plant it then?
Why not make it a like if a Manitowoc officer planted the key?
Yeah. So the next team, finds
I would have stepped outside of the trailer and said, "Hey, make sure to check, you know, everywhere next to the bookcase, and made sure that somebody else found it." Likewise with the bones. I mean, who in their right mind burns a body elsewhere and then plants the bones in the fire pit and then creates a scavenger hunt of sorts by placing bones all over the quarry and in various places? I mean, if you're going to plant somebody, you're going to go for, you know, you're going to go big or go home. All of the remains are going to be.
Yeah. I agree 100%.
Yeah. It's a great point.
That's the kind of stuff that swayed me. Cause I don't know if I answered this earlier. But you know, James mentioned he's still on the fence, but I've been, since we've gotten back into convicting a murderer, watched all that stuff and then kind of got back in the case, you know, after doing it years and years ago, I've been of the opinion that Steven's definitely guilty in some degree. Again, whether it happened exactly, we'll never know. Brendan, again, is the point, you know, what he's so all over the place. I believe he saw something. I believe he was involved to some degree, at least an accessory. Do I believe he was in the bedroom doing all that stuff? I don't know. There's no evidence there. We asked Brenda that, and of course we're just called Shields because we, you know, we're Daily Wire Shields or something now for some reason. We're getting paid, I guess, from the Daily Wire. Let me get that check. But yeah, so you know, just that lack of evidence in the trailer. But is it correct, correct me if I'm wrong, but the state's theory, at least, and again it's just a theory, was that he used a tarp because they found the grommets in the fire as well. Or what about the trailer evidence? Did that throw you off, and what made you change your mind there, or have you?
Oh well, I mean, initially I was all about, where's the blood, where's the DNA? Yeah, how come you can't find any DNA of Brendan's in there? How come you can't? But I mean, they're right. This isn't CSI. This isn't all the time, you know, dramas that you see on TV. This is real life. You know, people sometimes don't bleed. People sometimes don't leave DNA, or they leave partial foot or fingerprints. Steven was a greasy guy, first of all. So if he's touching things, you're probably not going to get fingerprints. You're probably just going to get, you know. And so when I started looking at it a little bit more rationally, I didn't have as much of a problem with that, honestly. I think it's pretty telling that he just bought a brand new rug doctor, moved his entire furniture around, moved his bed over to a weakened part of the trailer where, you know, it could very well fall through the floor. Right. And that, you know, I mean, that's why he was told not to put the bed on that side, is because, you know, I think it's very telling that all of those things, I mean, that's an awful lot of damn coincidences to happen to one person. You'd have to be the unluckiest person in the world, which making a murderer, you know, made him very much look out to be. But I found it very telling that he brought the rug doctor back because, you know, it just, he cleaned up for absolute certain. He cleaned up in there. Why? Stephen isn't, you know, a clean person. Yeah, so ironically, he has a fire, which he's not had in his pit on October 31st. And he's cleaned his entire bedroom, which he has not cleaned in forever. All of these things just kind of happen, when Teresa's murdered. And it doesn't make sense. Yeah.
And I think Brenda mentioned last week, they didn't even find his hair and he lives there.
Yeah.
So that seems to point to that, but I don't know. Was it confirmed that I know they showed the picture of the rug doctor. Do you know if it was confirmed that he did take it back? They believe he took it back. Was that confirmed in any way?
He told Jody in a phone call that he brought it, that he returned it and he bought something else. He was going to buy. It sounded like he was going to buy another rug doctor, but then he ended up with a Bissell instead.
Yeah. So that was like the box we saw.
But I mean, you know, I don't have as much of a problem regarding the DNA and the blood as much as I did at one point in time.
I just don't think she was ever in there.
You don't think so? I was on that for a while, and I'm still on the fence there.
Yeah, I can't believe Stephen Avery with a dust rag and a rug doctor beats, you know, CSI team.
Yeah.
It's just my theory. Really
trained to process a crime scene. We're not talking about homicide detectives that are trained specifically to deal in homicide. We're talking about a pretty small department that kind of deals with everything and doesn't really have to deal with this kind of stuff on a regular basis. And so were mistakes made? So many mistakes.
Yeah.
I have a huge question, aside from the not having any pictures of the fire pit. Why wasn't the mattress taken in for lab testing? I mean, as soon as the bedding was gone, disposed of, they just kind of, okay, well, that was burnt. There's where all the DNA is. Well, it's a mattress. There could be anything on it. So why wasn't that sent off and tested thoroughly?
Yeah.
I have issues. Is it enough for Stephen to get a new trial? Maybe. I'm not a lawyer. I still think you're going to garner the same result.
Yeah.
It's futile and a waste of money at this point in time, but there were definitely mistakes made. And I've asked everybody involved, would you have done things differently? And every single person has said, nobody has stood their ground and said, no, this was a perfect investigation.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Every single person has been humble enough to say, absolutely, there are many things that I would have done wrong.
Just, I hate to interrupt you, but honestly, sure. I think Kratz, his press conference, tainting, you know, the jury pool, even if they went somewhere else, I mean, you know, I don't know the reach of that television station or whatever.
But they argued to stay there too because they wanted the sympathy of the first conviction.
So it's just that alone to me.
I think you're right though. I don't think he could have possibly gotten a fair trial regarding the kind of poisoning of the jury pool with Kratz.
There's a lot of, I don't know, man. None of the things I'm saying, you know, doesn't mean that convicting a murderer hasn't just really blown my mind and made me look at these guys differently. Like, I don't even hate Kratz the way I used to anymore. He comes off, it doesn't matter. He himself says he's a narcissist. He admitted to having,
I had one encounter with him early on, and he was on Reddit, and I didn't do Reddit very much at all. Reddit is very much keyboard warriors with fake names. You never really know who you're talking to. And right. My mind doesn't work like that. I want to know who I'm talking to.
Yeah.
And so I feel better on like Facebook and sometimes Twitter, where I know who I'm talking to. And I've never had a fake account. I've never been one of those people.
Yeah, neither.
But I was on Reddit because that's where a lot of the information was happening. And that's where a lot of the underground information was happening. And so I was having a conversation with somebody and this guy piped up in defense of Ken Kratz. I wish I had it in front of me right now, actually. And I might after this dig it up and see if I can.
I think I know where she's going.
Yeah.
It's hysterical. Ken Kratz did an amazing job and he's one of the top attorneys in the area. And this is it was just like this long, and it had bullet points.
Oh,
Kratz did this and he did this and he's, blah. And it was just, I wish I could quote it right now because it's just so completely out there. It was laughable. And so one of my comments was, why are you in hiding, Kratz? Just come
out. Yeah, just come out and say it's you.
And it was like Buddy441 or something like that was his Reddit name. I'll look it up. And I'm like, why don't you just come out and say who you are? Why are you in hiding? And he slipped up and said, I'm not in hiding. And I was like, done. You know? And so, I mean, he came forward after that and said, okay, yeah, it's me. But I mean, it was so blatantly obvious. He's a bit full of himself. You know, and that press conference, I think he enjoyed it.
Honestly, yeah, they do.
Oh, yeah.
He made a decision and he wanted to be the first person to tell people all of those gruesome details. I think he enjoyed it. And I think as an afterthought, now he's probably like, yeah, I probably shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, he said that for sure.
He enjoyed every minute of that.
No doubt.
So, and that's unfortunate because, you know, it could have been left to the transcripts for people to, or to the report for people to read if they wanted to.
Right.
But this whole, you know, get your children out of the room. This is going to be a gruesome account. You know, her friends and family had to have seen that. And
yes.
You know,
yeah.
With zero regard for the consequences of doing that. And yeah, it's unfortunate. I think in this case, there's a lot of unfortunate things like that that tainted the entire thing. Ken Kratz being a shady individual allowed people to think all of them were shady.
Right.
One piece of evidence that was questionable made them question all of the evidence. It was just like this perfect collection of just enough doubt that made people doubt the entire case.
Right.
So, but I mean, realistically, cases have been won on way less evidence than what was against Stephen Avery. So,
yeah.
That's what we said is, well, you know, after stepping back and seeing this, is you just needed the blood. You didn't need all this other shit.
Yeah.
That key screwed up their case. They didn't need that key, and that key made things complicating.
No, it did. So speaking of the blood, so you mentioned it earlier just really quickly. So you were stuck on the blood thing too. So what changed your opinion on the blood thing was, because we said it was the way they showed us in convicting the murder that the car was parked and we never had even thought about him, you know, reaching in from the passenger side to drip that blood. And then his own car having blood in it almost exactly the same way. And they impounded that and never mentioned that in making a murder.
Never mentioned it.
So that was really a big thing because we were totally bought in when Zellner came in and did this testing and all this kind of stuff. We're like, see right there. It's physics. You can't change my mind. It doesn't matter if he burned an animal. He'd eat, you know, we said he's a piece of shit 3 years ago, but you can't change my mind on physics, right?
And if you do that and allow your kids to see that, they're going to limit themselves too, and they're not going to grow.
Absolutely. You brought a great point. The echo chambers, and whether it's online or whatever it may be, were so politicized and divisive. It's absolutely insane to me that people can't listen and consider. And that's why I appreciated you in the docuseries, because you were the one who were out there. You were picketing clearly in that camp, so to speak.
Yes.
On that team, wearing that jersey, whatever kind of arbitrary box you were supposed to be put in, but you were at least saying, I'm willing to hear.
Right.
And that's why I was so excited when you sent a message and had you on here. It's really been cool to hear your story.
I think one of the funniest things I saw in episode 10 is when I was arguing with Hoop. There is a follow-up to that they didn't include in the documentary that's fantastic, actually. So Hoop and I had like a 45-minute argument in front of the courthouse, arguing a whole bunch of, he was a guilter. And it was later, and I forgive you for this, Sean and Brenda, but it was later that I found out that whole damn thing was orchestrated. They literally approached me on purpose because I organized that rally and they knew exactly who I was.
Right.
They approached me as, look, we just want to talk to a few supporters. Yeah, they knew exactly who I was. And then they brought in Hoop, who just happened to be there, to have this conversation with me. Very convenient, right? And so we went at it back and forth. It's that scene where I said that I could argue the crap out of anything. I could argue paint off a house is what I said. I promise you, I've never said that before, ever.
Wow.
Like I've never said that since. When I saw that on episode 10, I was absolutely dumbfounded. Where the hell did that come from? I've never used that term before. Anyway, so we went back and forth, and I had some good points, and he had some good points, and it was actually, it was awesome. I think we kind of gave each other a high five, like one of those good game, you know, moments after we're done, you know.
Right.
I told him to reach out to me. I think he was a little intimidated too, but I told him to reach out to me because at that point in time, I said, I want to know more. I want to hear what you have to say about this and this and this. And, you know, maybe not behind camera where we can really have a conversation. And he never did. But I did that with a lot of guilters, honestly, because I wanted to hear what their take was on things. I wanted to consume as much information as I possibly could.
Right.
But while I was in Cleveland, I kind of jokingly said, hey, we should just call Hoop. And Brenda's like, really? And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. Let's film it. The person who was the cameraman at the time thought it was a dumb idea. But I said, no, this is going to be great. And so I'd actually like to hear that conversation again. So Brenda, you send it to me. But they pulled him up on the phone and we had a conversation about it. And I said, are you sitting down? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, I think I may have to concede that Steven is guilty. And he was like, sweet, it's about time, you know, but we had that moment and that was not in there also. But anyway, I was on a, mission here when I was talking about that, but, how it all started. It started in 2018 when we were at the rally and that whole thing went down. When I contacted them, about follow-up, I went to Cleveland and sat there. I'm trying to think of exactly where I was going with this. It was 3 days, honestly. When I left Cleveland, I didn't get to see anything of Cleveland. It was during COVID. And I came home with a shirt that said literally like a Cleveland shirt. And I made a post and like spent 4 days in Cleveland and all I got was this,
with this lousy t-shirt.
Yeah. And so I spent 3 days in there talking about all of the things, talking about my work with Kathleen, talking about, you know, various points, arguing with them still to stuff I was holding on to. I was still holding on to the Brendan thing pretty tightly when I was in Cleveland. I was okay with Steven being guilty, but I was still holding on to a lot of things regarding Brendan. As a matter of fact, I remember having a full breakdown at the Cleveland airport during layover on my flight back to the point where I was hyperventilating because I had to. I don't think people understand how emotionally involved you can get in something like this, but I literally had like a break where I was just like, that poor kid, that poor girl, that poor, you know what I mean? Like he definitely did this. He definitely was involved. He definitely, you know, and so I had to let some of that go. So when I say, I don't know where I was going with this, and I promise this is the only beer I've had tonight. when I say that it was a difficult road for me, I'm not lying. It was very painful for me. It was very hard. And I don't know that many people are able to do that or willing to do that. And so I hope they are. I hope people are allowed to allow more information in and allow themselves to acknowledge without guilt, without feeling as though there's something wrong with them. You were manipulated into believing something it was untrue and you held on to it. And it's a painful thing to let go of. And it changed my life and I kind of want it over with now, which is why I'm doing this podcast. So if anybody has any questions for me, I'm just going to direct them to you because this chapter is closed for me. We might follow up and do a little bit more. I was talking to Brenda earlier and she's like, I'm going to need you for a few more things. And as long as I feel as though it is helping people cross that bridge or helping people understand, regardless of which way they end up on, whichever side you end up on, you have to be willing to look at all of it and at least acknowledge that you were manipulated and that some of what you believe is wrong. As long as it's still within that spectrum of why I got involved in the first place, in convicting a murderer in the first place, I'll continue doing a few things. But for the most part, this chapter's over for me. You know, it was a long haul.
I'm glad you brought that up. I think that's hugely important that, you know, we were all duped and it's okay. We don't know what we don't know. We all just came across this documentary. We heard people talking about it. We were duped.
Yeah.
Even if you still believe some aspects or whatever, they clearly edited that thing to make the cops look bad and played ominous music. I don't know you know, Sean said this on other podcasts, so I can say this, you know, they had notes from Netflix to make it worse. Mm-hmm. You know, they absolutely, so they brought this thing and then Netflix said, you know, no, here, add this and, you know, change this. So not only did they have an agenda, but the Netflix made it even worse. So it's okay to be fooled by something. You don't know what you don't know. And it's really odd. It's like I mentioned to you earlier, it's like flat earth. I mean, most of the people don't actually believe that. They just won't let go of their communities. That's their life.
Right.
It's really odd. It's like you're not allowed to leave the religion or even have a question about the religion. Even if you don't fully leave, you know, believe it, or you still believe some aspects or whatever, that's okay too. But this stubbornness to even listen to another side these days is really odd. And we've never seen anything like in our life. I mean, people used to talk, you know?
Yes.
And have conversation and understand there's nuance to everything. It's not just black and white. So it's really, really odd.
Yeah. Communication is a challenge. I just had a post on Facebook about it recently. I was trying to determine whether or not the gap in communication with a specific age group beneath me was because I'm getting old. I'll be 53 in December. But I was finding it difficult to communicate with the generation before me and even a couple of people in my generation. I find communication just challenging in general lately. But things like cliche words like toxic and boundaries and, you know, just get thrown around all over the place. And what happened to the days where you could talk to somebody and say, hey, this is a thing that you're doing that's upsetting me or it's causing me harm. And, you know, and then we have a discussion about it. And then that person goes, well, I mean, I can see where you're coming from, but I don't, you know, a conversation, right? Yeah. And nowadays, when you try to have a conversation with them, if it's a conversation they don't like or it makes them feel negative in any way, they shut you up. They block it. They don't want to hear another word.
Because another word that they're throwing around these days, triggered.
Yeah.
Everybody's triggered by something.
Everybody's triggered. The word gaslit is being thrown around. Definition. If somebody says something to you that makes you feel negative about your own actions, then you are being gaslit. And I'm like, that's not really how this works. That's not right. You know, conflict is healthy. Communication is healthy. Discussion is healthy. And I think most people just are content if the conversation isn't going the direction that they want it to go, then it's toxic and I'm setting up boundaries. I'm not going to do that anymore. Right. And it's just not allowing people to grow. And so, I mean, I guess I hope by watching this that people, you know, don't view it as toxic or that they're being lied to. I love it when people equate Cam with ma'am. Like, well, they're doing the exact same thing that I can attest to the fact that I was in episode 2, 4, 6, 8 and the final, and not a single ounce of my footage was edited. Or cut out or twisted or made to look like, you know, it was something other than it was. I hope people grow from this. I hope people take a look. It sounds like most people are. But there are going to be people that you just cannot change their mind. They will hold on no matter what.
Yeah. There's something there, whether it's like, I think it goes into, you know, being a part of something bigger than yourself or whatever, you know, just some kind of community to hold on to, like flat earthers or whatever it may be. Again, I'm just using that because I've went down that rabbit hole. I'm just curious about the psychology behind it. A lot of our podcasts are based on that, you know, no matter the topic, it's kind of the psychology behind things.
For me, I take some accountability in this. I wasn't just duped by a documentary. I mean, I made calculated decisions. I made choices. Yeah. I'm accountable for all of my actions and my way of thinking back then. But for me, it was during a time in my life where I was working from home. I hadn't settled into a career yet. I did major in law at one point in time and then changed my, you know, major several times and then got married and had kids and, you know, life happened. But there was that burning desire to make a difference. And this felt like an opportunity to do that. Like I was making change, right? It felt like I was contributing to something that could change, the way things are done. And that's part of what I held on to. It didn't really have anything to do with innocent or guilty. It had to do with the fact that I was holding on to this belief that I could make a difference. Right. And when you have to acknowledge that you've made no difference at all, and that you, you know, you led, you in fact actually led people astray.
Right.
That's a hard, that's a jagged pill to swallow. And sure. So a lot of these people are still, I don't think it's regarding innocence or guilty for them either. They're holding on because they have podcasts and they have Twitter and they have all these things that they've built and created because they set out to make a difference. And if that's, if that means nothing, then what does that say about them? Right. That's the thing that they're holding on to. That's the, and I feel bad for them because I was there.
Well, when you hear people who have left like the Church of Scientology and they're disavowed or whatever, do you feel that way? Like some of your old friends will no longer talk to you or anything?
That's
or?
What I was going to say too, is was it worse with the whole transition from like your in like internally that you had been duped and then, you know, kind of had put yourself in this echo chamber? Or was it when you did finally change your mind, the people you were associated with then started, which was worse, you know, to, just to,
you know, like I was never, I was never a fan and I was never out to make friendships and I was never one of those people. I didn't become part of a community necessarily. And the mindset anyway, yes, I hosted rallies. Yes. I communicated with people. But I have a great life. I married my best friend. I have great kids. I have a great community. This is my life. Mam was never my life. Right. And so, I don't really have any feelings about that at all. Those, I mean, I made maybe a couple of friendships, but I probably have more friendships with guilters now than I ever did with truthers. And so that part never really mattered to me. So I didn't really care if people call me a traitor or they call me, you know, it never really bothered me because I didn't set out to, you know, I was never part of the mammaly.
I've never heard that one.
Is what they call
it. Okay.
The mammal.
I have a relationship with Carla and she knows where I stand. I never hid that from her. I have a good relationship. Danielle, actually, her daughter was one of Jet's good friends. They actually drove all the way from Wisconsin in one day for Jet's memorial and then had to turn right around and drive all the way back because Carla had to help her sister move. And so I have a good relationship with Earl. I actually made him cupcakes on his birthday a few years ago. And so he and I are in communication. I check in with them occasionally and just say, hey, how you doing? You know, people making your life hell. I wouldn't say we're tight, you know, right. There's definitely some dysfunction in that family. But I respect them and they are, in my opinion, regardless of their mistakes and the things that they've done, and some of them have done in their past, this has turned their life upside down too. Right. I mean, it's, you know, this whole story and Mam making a murder destroyed a lot of lives. I firmly believe that Brendan will probably never, ever tell us the truth. And it's because of making a murderer. Because he has friends that he never had before. He had
That's right.
That's true.
Looking out for his best interest that he probably never had. He has people who write him letters constantly and send him books and keep his commissary full and take care of him. And he's not ever going to be able to. And the sad truth is if he found new representation right now, he could probably get an Alford plea.
We just said that last week. I was like, I wish he could just go. Yeah. Just go offer everything in detail. Get out.
Had it not been for his selfish family, he could have taken a plea deal and had an adult life.
Yeah.
And so making a murder destroyed a lot of people's lives. The Averys, that entire family, law enforcement, Brendan. The only one that seems to be benefiting from making a murderer is Steve.
It got a lot of fans and girlfriends and wives and supporters.
Oh, some of the stuff I had to deal with back then. So many girlfriends, so many fans, so many. There were so many things that I had to keep out of public eye.
Oh, wow.
I had the pictures of, and that was hard. The pictures of Stephen with his daughter long before they came out. And the first thing I did, and this is not something I'm proud of, the first thing I did is I sent a letter to Kathleen and said, these pictures exist. Somebody's threatening to leak them. You need to be aware before they come out. And that was probably in 2018.
Wow.
And so, and that's not a proud moment. but again, my mind was of the mindset, Steve is a vile person. That doesn't make him a murderer.
Sure. So, going real quick, your job again was to kind of block that type of information, filter the information. How did that end? How did that relationship end? If you came, you know, to believe he's guilty, how did what happened there?
I left adminning the family group right before. There was too many things that I couldn't ignore. I was fielding messages from Lynn, his fiance at a time. I was messaging.
Wow.
I knew all about the bags of cum that he was sending to supporters. And I knew all about, I mean, it was just like.
That floored me.
And the private letters that he was sending to, you know, family members. And I mean, I knew a lot of this stuff. I had communication with Carl Wernicke. Did you ever watch the short reels episode called, I think it's Confessions of a Killer or something like that, about Stephen Avery's old inmate?
The only thing I saw on his own in his cellmate, where he said he was drawing sex dungeons and all that kind of shit.
Yeah, no, there's an actual, it was released in 2020 on reels. And I think it's called Confessions of a Killer, Stephen Avery story or whatever. If you go to Amazon Prime, I think Reels has like a 7-day free trial or whatever. Just look up Stephen Avery and that episode will pop up. That's Carl Wernicke, and he was his inmate for 3 years, the first run in prison, where Stephen Avery consumed true crime shows and was always rooting for the murderer and like almost watched it like education. Like it was constant in their room. They watched it repeatedly where he would say, you know, he should have done this, or he could have gotten away with it if he did this, or kind of, you know, rude and talking when he'd see a scene where a girl would get raped, you know, he would say things like that bitch deserved it. And I mean, he had that mindset growing in prison. According to Carl, he will tell you that prison made him into a murderer.
Right.
I believe that there's probably an element of truth to that, but I also think that there was pretty significant propensity to commit some sort of violence against women before he went into prison.
Right.
The first time, the red flags were definitely there. But Carl will go into specifically his preoccupation with burning evidence and fires. And he will talk. Initially, he talked about, you know, it's easy to get rid of a body. You can put him in a wood chipper, or you can feed him to pigs, or, you know, and he would talk pretty often about things like that. But it shifted at some point in time when he started watching more episodes regarding the burning of evidence. And he would talk often about burning this and burning that. And, you know, anyway, it's, you know, take it for a grain of salt. He's also an inmate. The guy's
sure.
Been living out of prison since 2004 with a respectable life. Weirdly enough, we come full circle because he has a mutual friend with me. Apparently, they worked together years ago someplace, an old friend of mine from when I was younger. I was really surprised to discover that. I don't really talk to that person much anymore, but I did reach out to her and I said, hey, what do you think of this guy? You know, is he telling the truth? Is he full of crap? And she's like, no, I mean, he's a pretty straight up guy. And he was in prison for like burglaries and theft and never anything violent, pretty quiet right. guy. And so I got him on the phone and I talked to him for a long time about, you know, and he was very candid. If he didn't have an answer to something, he'd say, I don't know. People that lie tend to fill in gaps and tell you, you know, tell you all kinds of things. But I mean, it was very enlightening hearing from him what Stephen was like before all of this. I think it was brewing. I think when he came out, he was a celebrity and he felt like women owed him and he was untouchable and he'd gotten off for a wrongful conviction once and he had learned how to commit a crime and leave very little evidence behind and get away with it because everybody loved him. Everybody thought he was
right. That's a theme that keeps kind of a reoccurring theme is the untouchable theme. Mm-hmm. I think we've mentioned that quite a bit in the last few podcasts about it. The things you said. So you said you were, you know, you're 100% now that he's guilty.
What I don't like 100% about anything, but I mean,
well, sure. Yeah. So you know? what are your biggest, do you still have doubts? You said Brendan, some stuff, any particular evidence or whatever that you have doubts about still?
No. And it's not because if I thought about it, I could probably pick out a few things, but I quit looking at it and I quit looking at it like most people do in one little thing, like this thing, because you can question every one thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Once you've seen the whole picture, once the 3D image pops up, like I talked about,
right,
none of the little itty bitty things matter anymore. And they're just not, I can't look at them separately anymore. It's like a person going to a doctor with all of these different symptoms and finding out it's this diagnosis, this condition that's causing all of these, you know, symptoms. For me, it's kind of like that. I can't not look at it as the big picture anymore.
Right.
And so I don't really pay mind to the little things, which is why I don't answer questions. Like when people ask me, so what do you think about this? I don't really have time for it. And I don't really care anymore. When people ask me, well, what makes you think, you know, this is acceptable? It doesn't really matter to me anymore because I've seen it. I see it too clearly now. Do I think that there are things wrong with the investigation still? Yeah. I mean, you'd have to be an idiot in order to think that mistakes weren't made. But, you know, we're also human. Humans make mistakes, including law enforcement.
Yes.
When I spoke to people about specifically Colburn, Link, Fassbender, and Wiegert, which are like the key law enforcement that caused all these shenanigans, right? What I'm hearing from everybody, and I talk to a lot of people, is that Andy Colburn is, and this was mentioned by two different people who use this exact term. Andy Colburn is like the Barney Fife of Manitowoc. He's not very bright, but there's no way on earth that that man's integrity can be questioned.
Right.
You know, and that was said like almost word for word by two completely separate people. Link has been described to me by people as somebody who follows the letter. Like he doesn't let he doesn't let anybody get away with not following the rules or doing the paperwork or staying on top of everything.
We said that because that's the explained the whole, you know, when Colburn took the call originally back in the 85 case or whatever, and he was just not even a sworn deputy at the time, just a jailer. And then later on having that conversation saying, making the whatever the off the cuff comment he made about the sheriff and we had the right guy, but it never actually happened, that conversation. Then Link goes and writes a report about it, which is like, that seems like a guy that's like straight by the book.
No, he's he comes across to me, and what I've heard from people is just kind of a bland personality, probably maybe even some spectrum traits. Sorry if that's not the case, do not hold that against me. But I mean, just like Spock, like super logical. You have to follow the rules. And if somebody is outside of the boundaries of following the rules, he's going to call you on it and make it. And so those do not seem like the pair that are going to drum up this conspiracy and frame people. That, and we're talking about a really small community where people are vying for certain positions in law enforcement there, because it is a small community. It's a small department. And there's a bit of infighting. I've heard from more than a handful of people that there's some squabbling amongst law enforcement. If some sort of conspiracy took place that involved law enforcement doing anything, including framing, murdering somebody, moving a vehicle, somebody would have talked by now. Absolutely. Yes. Somebody would have said something. And it would have all unraveled. And we're also talking about people who don't have any other negative remarks on their records at all. I mean, I've dug into them, minor things, maybe minor accusations that never led to anything, but we're talking really minor, not framing somebody for murder. And so that's a really big leap. And if you've watched all of this and you've looked into the case and you've done all of these things and you're still able to make that leap, I got no time for you. I don't even want to have a discussion with those people. I don't really block people, but once that comes out, I block. I just, because I don't even want to see what they have to say. It's so frustrating.
Yeah, we said, you know, we said to each other.
I said something about it's amazing how many people are still dipped in the dumb sauce is what I said to her yesterday, because it's just like
Yeah, we said to each other, you know, if you believe in this conspiracy, you got to believe the cops either killed her or they worked with a killer.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, how you get there logically.
Yeah. I'm interested to see what Zellner says.
I think it's very interesting that she's been quiet.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't at all doubt now after episode 10, if she doesn't make a tweet that's somehow passively aggressive directed towards me. I've been kind of watching to see. She can't sue me because there's no, you know, there's no non-disclosure agreement between the two of us, which is, you know, I'm thankful for. I don't have anything super negative to say about Kathleen Zellner. Although I do think a part of her, if not all of her, knows that he's guilty. I think she jumped on the bandwagon with everybody else. When I talked to her that first time, January 12th, and I was fangirling like you would not believe. I did a phone call from Kathleen Zellner. I submitted all of my information and I expected an assistant to call me maybe and follow up and ask me a couple more questions. But she called me and we were on the phone for like two and a half hours that day talking about all of the ins and outs of everything. And I was so nervous. I grabbed a bottle of wine and I couldn't find a wine glass. And it turns out that a bottle of wine will fill a beer mug like twice. And so by the end of the conversation, I was pretty buzzed. My husband came home and he rarely has seen me drink here. I mean, I don't get drunk very often. And we've been together 23 years and he came home and I was so day drunk. She called me at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon and he came home from work and I was like, you're not going to believe what happened to me today.
Yeah.
But I mean, I do admire her a great deal.
Oh yeah.
But
that's part of what sealed it. You know, when season two came out and then,
if Kathleen took this case, then absolutely. I mean, that was part of the selling factor for me. Cause she's clearly got to know stuff. I don't know.
That's right.
And he must be innocent. Cause she would not take after her, that one case where she had to keep quiet. Can't remember the guy's name. He confessed to her and told her where all the bodies were and all the information. Right. And she couldn't say anything until he died. And she swore, I will never represent anybody guilty again. I mean, I took that to heart. I was like, so if she took this case, he's absolutely innocent.
That's exactly.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I worked with her very willingly, giving her information. At one point in time, I was trying to obtain Scott's DNA for her. You know, I mean, it was just like... Wow. We had various discussions about the validity of that particular theory and that argument. And, you know, I was at a barbecue and he kept smoking his cigarettes and taking his cigarette butts and tucking them in his pocket instead of putting them in the ashtray. and so, I mean, you know, he's an oddball and he didn't murder Teresa. So I'm going to go on record as saying that right now. But I mean, I was super, super in it. And then I started seeing some of the crazy tweets that she was putting out and some of the stuff that she was putting in her appeals and the things that she was going after and the way she was shifting gears. It's Ryan, it's Bobby, it's, you know.
Yeah.
And Mike Grisbach and I had a great conversation about it because he actually featured the suspect that I was working on in his book. He did a whole chapter about the German and both he and I had a conversation about it. And we're like, why did she, I mean, so what? His wife isn't going to do the affidavit. This is still the most valid alternate suspect she has. Why did she ever not go down that road? Because in our opinion, based on what we'd seen, it even made him question. If you read his book, he even says like, I was reading this whole thing in the German and I was just like, maybe we got the wrong guy again. And so I couldn't understand that.
I'm fascinated by that. I'd never heard that till you said it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's go back and read his book. There's a whole chapter on it. And so I started losing a little bit of faith. You know, she had me at hello. When she said that the science was going to turn this whole thing on its heel. And then the age testing came back. Nope. It didn't show that it came from the vial, no EDTA, no,
right.
and some of the other scientific testing. And then I started seeing the reenactments. Now, this is a woman who, I don't know, I can't remember. Did she throw a pig off a building, the weight of a person, to confirm that? I can't remember. I read previously that she had done some pretty profound reenactments to prove her case, right?
Right.
And what did we get? Kathleen in the middle of a field with a tiny grill and some charcoal and a phone, and they light it with lighter fluid. They're reenacting the bonfire, or the burn barrel.
Right.
And her, while her staff walks around and said, smells like marshmallows, you know, and like, she has access to the Avery property. Surely she could, if she bought the same exact RAV4, she could buy the exact PDA, the exact camera, the exact phone, the exact circumstances, and reenact the burn barrel thing. Exactly. Right. No, she does a tiny little tabletop grill in the middle of nowhere. And that was her reenactment. And I was just like, okay, well, yeah. I mean, is right. she really in it anymore? I mean, is her heart in this case anymore? If that's what she's presenting as evidence. And it seemed like she was spending more time arguing with people on Twitter than actually putting together cases.
Right.
Sorry, not sorry. And so, yeah, that was a hard, I still think she's a very intelligent woman. She's extremely intelligent.
Oh, yeah,
She has managed to overturn cases that nobody would stand a chance doing. And I have mad respect for her. But what I've seen leads me to believe that maybe she got in over her head and was also manipulated by making a murderer, and is now representing somebody that she thinks might be guilty. It could be wrong, and I'm sure I'll hear about it on Twitter.
No, yes, you definitely will. speaking of her, the only thing she said was, you know, I think, was it today or yesterday? I sent that to mm-hmm. you. So she announced it, you know, new judge. But, you know, I saw the replies, and everybody thinks this is some kind of big win. But Angela herself, Judge Angela, requested this.
Right.
Herself. I saw the document.
Yep, I know.
So I don't know how this is some big, huge win or whatever for Stephen Avery.
I miss the days when people would talk about the Zelnami that was coming.
Yeah.
Because remember those days where people talked about the big Zelnami that was coming, and it was always going to be. And I think that's part of the thing that was disheartening for me, too, is you'd be chomping at the bit waiting because that day is going to come that she's going to walk yes. up to the courthouse and she's going to, and it's going to be this new revelation. And then you'd read through it and you're like, nope, that's pretty anticlimactic.
Right. She's got a couple of supposed witnesses. And then I think we asked Brenda about them, and it was, you know, somebody wasn't sure of the dates, and there was a mailman. Then it was somebody else who saw Bobby supposedly, but it wasn't the right date. I don't know. There wasn't.
Right.
It seemed to be like this new revelation. But that's been really about it, to my knowledge.
Right. I watched that live footage the first time she went to the courthouse to file her first appeal. And I was absolutely giddy. I was just like seriously fangirling. And that was that was another hard thing to let go of, you know, when you put somebody on that high of a pedestal and you have all that faith in them. And you have to acknowledge that, you know, they are not producing what you'd hope that they would produce, or they're not the person, you know what I mean? What I saw in the tweets feel like another level of manipulation, you know, and taunting. As soon as the taunting started, I was like, I lost respect. You know, I still have respect for her, but it is not anywhere near where it used to be. Right. As soon as she was calling out guilters and starting fights with people, and I'm like, you're an intelligent woman. Stay the course. Do your job. you know, you don't need to succumb to all of this. And looking back on it, I think one of the things that has always bothered me is that conversation I had with her on January 12th. She hadn't even met Stephen yet. She was actually on her way to Manitowoc to meet him that weekend. And so that was a little bit telling for me. I mean, I overlooked it at the time because I was super excited for her and the case and all the, and she's going to do some great things. But she hadn't even met him yet. She watched Making a Murderer like everybody else. She probably ignored 3 to 4 years of letters she got from Sandy and Steven over the years. And saw the hype behind Making a Murderer and saw how big it was going to be. Personally, I believe that she didn't take it because she thought he was innocent. I think she took it because there was an opportunity to have another case on the heels of another high publicity case.
And it's, I think she likes a challenge.
She had the Dream Killer documentary had just been released, and that was becoming big. And it was just like the next thing, the next big thing that would thrust her into the limelight. There's a perfect storm, this whole Making a Murderer thing.
I agree.
Yes.
It was the timing. It was the people involved. It was the, And so I can't say that I regret it entirely. I don't like to say I regret anything because everything you do in life leads you to the point that you're at. And it's a moment that you need to grow. But God, I wasted a lot of time on this shit.
I don't think you're alone. I don't think you're alone.
No, you're not.
Anyway, if you got more questions for me, I mean, I can stay up as late as you want. I grab my.
You have any specific questions? I wanted you just let you go. Like you said before, you didn't get to tell your A to B story, and that's what I wanted to hear from. I'm glad you.
Did you get enough of it? Did I fill in some gaps for you?
No, I think definitely. So. Absolutely.
Have you been on the property where the red trailer he lived in?
Oh, lots of times. I've been in the trailer.
Okay, how between the trailer
put that in there
where Barb
lived? That's fine. We weren't supposed to be in the trailer at the time because it's not sound. That whole thing is going to collapse any day now.
Right.
Oh, wow.
But I mean, it's really bad. And one of the things I had a big issue with is that propane tank that was right there. I still do have a little bit of an issue with that because that's pretty risky. The fire pit is a hell of a lot closer to the garage than you would think just looking at pictures.
Really?
And the propane tank was parked directly behind the trailer, kind of in between. You can see it in the pictures. In between, like, I'm thinking if you're going to have that big of a fire, and it had to have been pretty big, that's pretty close to a propane tank. And so when I first looked at the when you first look at the property and you are there, that visual is a little bit jarring. That's a pretty big risk. Like you could have blown up all of that shit.
Yeah.
So at the time I had a big issue with it. Right now I'm probably like, oh, he was damn lucky. As far as I'm concerned, you can see evidence on the back of that, garage that whatever was there was pretty hot. You look at the front of the garage and the sides of the garage and then the back of the garage, and there's no reason for the back of the garage to look as, it's peeling and the paint that's peeling is curled and it just looks maybe like it was exposed to some heat. That's never really been brought up, and that's not a professional opinion. That's just a layman's opinion
looking
at the back of the garage. I've been that salvage yard is huge. I can send you some pictures of me there if you want. I was led to believe that the Pam of God walk was different than it was. So there's actually a video of me taking the exact walk that everybody thought she took, which is pretty much a straight shot to the car, when in fact it was actually a little bit different. Was she lucky? Yeah. I'm still not sold on one theory. That she just happened to find it. I think that there is a possibility somebody on that property was there without permission and saw it and then said, hey, we need permission to get on the property because it's over there.
I have a theory on your theory there. Ryan Hilligus.
I have the exact same. I don't like to throw people's names in there, they were pretty feverishly looking around that Avery property, and Ryan did lead up a lot of it. And that area right there is pretty open, especially in the fall. The leaves have all like fallen. I mean, there is a possibility that you could be close enough to the Avery property too to see kind of, a vehicle that's green covered up and stuff. Yeah. I'm still not sold that God.
Yeah, right.
Shit, right.
I do think it's interesting that Peg will center with the camera. And I do, I mean, it's just like, but if that's the worst that they did in manipulating, trying to get information, I'm cool with that. So you saw the car and you weren't supposed to be on the property and you needed to get on there officially so that you could locate it. Right. I don't have a problem with that, honestly.
Cause he's asked, he's doing an interview and the reporter asks something about, have you been on there? So you were on the property, and he was real quick to go, no, I wasn't.
Right.
I was never on the property. And Mike is like, and he looks at Mike, and Mike says, oh no, we've never been on the property or something. And I don't know. It's
one of those things that if you can doubt one little piece, and that's what this whole documentary does. That's what this whole case does. If you can if you can doubt one person, then you must be able to doubt everybody. If you can doubt one piece of information, then all of it's like shady. You know, I'm okay with a few things being questionable and the rest of it being valid.
Yeah, I mean, the other side of that is, you know, if it was a family member of mine or loved one, I would absolutely sneak on there
at night with a flashlight looking around.
Absolutely.
You're darn right, I would.
But it was not planted there. So was it maybe somebody see it there before it was found? Sure. If it were me searching for a vehicle on the Average salvage yard, there's a clear entrance to the pit. Like, you know, you wouldn't go that way. So what I was led to believe is that they actually went into the office, talked to Earl, asked him if they had permission to search the property, then left the office and went around the back of the office building, straight down that gravel road, past the crusher, and went up into the pit. Pit is. Fun fact, though, when I did that Pam of Gone walk, I got bit by a tick and ended up with Lyme. So making a murderer is the gift that keeps giving.
Yeah.
Right in the groin area too. Too much. Man. But yes, I on the way home discovered that I was bit by a tick and had the full bullseye on there. And so, I still struggle with some Lyme stuff because of it. So thank you, making a murderer, for that. And so what actually happened, according to them, is they kind of split off in front of the offices and kind of went each row of cars. And then Pam was like, oh, wait a minute. We don't want to forget those cars up there. So let's take a look. Is that logical? I mean, I guess
it could.
Sure.
It seems pretty lucky, but because that place is huge. I walked the entire place and it's huge. I was there for hours. And so it wouldn't be the direction I would have gone, but
so you're telling me that Andy Colburn wasn't behind the license plate or on the car with the license plate at the church parking lot talking to the zippers?
No.
Okay. Just making sure, because I keep hearing that now.
You know, and I mean, I can actually physically see what happened. Now, was I up in an uproar about the whole damn thing at the time? Absolutely. Like, why is he calling it a plate? He's standing right in front of the vehicle.
Oh, absolutely.
And at that point in time, I was even like, okay, they found her vehicle and they moved it under the Avery property, because if I could suggest that law enforcement was involved at all, it would have been like they said in CAM, where it was because they already had enough evidence against him and they needed more, or they already knew that he did it and they just wanted to solidify their case.
Right.
That did not happen, in my opinion, especially now that we have the timestamp and we know exactly where Andy Colburn was when those plates were called. And when he explains it, it's just so
It makes
childlike and simple. I mean, he was driving his car. Somebody gave him a plate. He grabbed a notepad. He wrote it in the dark while trying to drive a car. And then he looked at it and go, oh, I can't read my writing. I have to call this and make sure that I've got the right plate number. And that's why he called it in. And it's so simple.
It really is. I mean, it's confirmed they were talking to the zippers at that time, right after that, when he was waiting on the other officers.
I just found it very endearing at the end of episode 10, where he's just like, if they can do it to me, like I felt that every conversation I've had with anybody about Andy Colburn is like, he is the last person that you would accuse doing anything like this. And so when he was just like, if they can accuse me, or if they can make me look bad, they can do it to anybody. Mm-hmm. I felt that, like,
I definitely got that feeling when he said in Cam that I was tired of seeing his porn collection. Like, it seemed like, you know, didn't even want to see some magazines or whatever, just to throw them in a box. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Stephen Avery, I don't know if you know about this, but had a wall on his, in his trailer of conquests.
No.
We heard something about that. Maybe Teresa had been there on the 10th before, you know, prior, which is when the bus driver apparently saw her, according to Brenda and the metadata from her camera, because the bus driver didn't know the date and ended up being the 10th apparently, but there was something where she may have collected money from at his front door. And he said something then about that wall.
Yes,
that's right.
Yeah. Maybe someday you'll be on that wall. And she told to two completely different friends who do not know each other.
Right. Right.
And so, I mean, he had it in his head, and he probably picked up that vibe from her. And that probably is what set him off. He probably said something to that effect. And her response was like, I mean, how do you hide your facial expression?
Right.
Somebody that creepy says something like that to you. And she's like, okay, well, I'll be going now. You know, he probably picked up on that rejection then, and then set this entire thing in motion. I thought that it was a heat of the moment thing where he may have hit on her on the 31st.
We were just talking about that. Yeah.
But no, I think this was set in motion a long time ago. I think that that October 10th incident set him off. I had a hard time making that leap to heat of passion moment, or is it premeditated? Premeditated side now, where he had this whole thing planned out. Right.
Yeah, that's what Brenda said last week. We had wondered that too. Like, was because now if you think about adding the computer evidence in there to him knowing about the computer, and he had access to Barb's house and when she had internet, and, you know, James made that great point that he seemed to know more about when she had internet than she did. Then that, you know, I don't know if they'd ever time all those searches and all the stuff that was on that PC, but that would certainly fit if they could.
Yeah. Barb sat with me in a quiet room once in the dark, and told me that. This is a long time ago, mind you. I think this is the rally of 2016. It was like the first summer rally that was in Manitowoc. And she told me she thought at the time she thought Teresa was alive and that those were animal bones. Well, I'd already known enough about the case and the evidence.
Right.
No differently. Right. And so if I had to pick one moment where I thought that the family knows, or that my brain was shifting even just the tiniest bit, it was probably that moment. We were sitting on the couch at Carla's house in the dark, and she's like, I think Teresa's still alive. I think this is entirely a hoax. She thought the Hallbucks were in on it. The Hallbucks are in on it.
Yes.
At Teresa's still alive, and those are bird bones, is what she said. Not just animal bones, but bird bones. And my head just kind of went, okay. But I've had many dealings with this family and many late night conversations and many things have slipped. I mean, they're pretty good at not, you know, not doing a lot of talking. But I'm also pretty good at reading between the lines on a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the consensus is everybody knew he was guilty when this went down, but that he did 18 years for something he didn't do. And even if he did kill her, he already did the time.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just kind of the vibe I got from people.
That was kind of the big deal. We said in Cam was with Earl saying, you know, a part of me don't want to believe it, but I think he's guilty. And he starts pointing the finger to everybody else and his own brothers and every, I don't know. It's just very odd.
Yeah. I think maybe with the exception of Dolores, everybody knew he was guilty. Everybody was willing to ignore that he was guilty because, they were all pretty angry and shook by the fact that he did 18 years. And there was going to be money on the line. He promised every single person there money for this, new houses, new cars, new, you know, whatever. And as much as they say that they don't care about money, and as they say that poor people lose all the time, They're not poor.
Right. We got that revelation from Brenda last week. Yeah, we didn't think about the property up.
Did Brenda talk about that? Did I miss
it? She mentioned something about they're not as poor as people think. They have money, yeah. You know, at least the family. I don't know about individuals, but yeah.
But, you know, honestly, he deserved a lot of money. And
$400,000 really doesn't seem like a lot, does it, for what he endured?
No. That was terrible that he settled for that, and that they got to say, you know, no wrongdoing or whatever. But he deserved a lot of money, and I can totally see, you know, telling people you're going to buy them houses and things. They probably put a lot of money on his books over the years while he was in there. 18 years is a long time. You know,
nobody really paid attention to Steve in those 18 years while he was in there, as far as his family goes. I mean, if you look at his, it's been a long time. So don't hold me to anything. But I mean, if you look at their visitation logs, like Steven's the first 18 years that he did, or if you look at the visitation logs from this crime up until making a murderer, nobody really paid attention. Nobody really went out of their way to see him or.
I'm sure it mattered.
But Candy, I did not know that. But Candy didn't even know for a couple of years that Earl had a brother named Steven.
Yeah, that was wild.
Which is just like, okay.
That was wild.
I mean, are there not pictures up at like at the Ma and Pa's house or, you know? yeah. So,
well,
I mean,
we got a sense of that, at least it's just a sense of it. I mean, again, just watching Cam, when we heard the conversations between Dolores and Steven, and she's asking about some of these other things, like it's almost like she was questioning things herself. You know, what about the cat thing? And he blamed it on somebody else and all that stuff. So that was pretty powerful, just to, you know, because you gotta have some questions.
I have notes. If you see me looking down a lot, it's just because I, you know, you tell me that I'm a good storyteller and that I'm articulate and that I stay on track, but you should see the ADHD that's going on in my brain most of the time. I'm usually juggling a million different things at once. And so sometimes I like to make notes. And so earlier, while I was re-listening to a lot of your podcasts with Brenda, I was making little notes on certain things. And now I'm puzzled because there are a couple of things I've written here that I can't read my own writing on.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's me. That's me all the time.
And so, but I think I've covered most of the things that I had written down here. So if there's anything that you guys want, if you have any more questions.
I think I'm good as far, I mean, I just wanted you to get on here and be able to tell your story and just kind of listen along and have, you know, kind of natural conversation flow from that. I don't think I have anything more specific. I think that was it. Like the big pieces of evidence that you know, initially thought, you know, were, you know, planted or whatever it may be, whether it's trailer or all that stuff, but you jumped right in and covered most of that, I think.
And I, you know, you were way deeper in it than I thought you were going to be.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Being in with the family group and the Zellner team. Yeah.
The fact that you admitted to getting one of those bags from Steven in the mail, that blows my mind.
Oh, I didn't get any. No. Oh, no. I've been punked. Yeah. Did you see me jump back with the?
Yes. That's just. We gotta use that for a clip. We gotta use that for a short.
I call that the Stevie Jeebies. yeah, no, there's
We're
a
getting
lot
all kinds of new terms from her tonight. Mm-hmm. We got the Stevie Jeebies,
the mammaly.
We got the, what was the walk of God?
Yeah, the mammaly.
Oh, Gam of God walk.
Yes.
The mammaly.
I love it. I love it.
I've never written a letter to that man. I never wrote a letter to Brendan. I mean, I was never that person. I didn't, you know, did I have some voids in my life that I was trying to fill by getting involved in this? Sure. But I think that there are people out there that had far deeper voids. They needed this connection with people.
Yeah.
They needed to, there was a lot of maternal feelings for Brendan.
I feel for those people.
Yeah. And those are the people that I feel really sad for. And they're probably the ones that are going to send hate mail in your comments under your video.
Oh yeah. We'll get them.
But I mean, I feel for you. Sorry. I mean, you know,
no, that's okay.
We know what we're getting into. You know, that's the thing. We just we've said this the whole time, and then we get accused of all kinds of stuff. We just talked about the case. It was a fascinating case, and we started 3.5 years ago, whatever we did. I think we did 2 original podcasts, one when it came out, and then we did an update, I believe, with a Zellner update. We were totally bought in, but we didn't make it our lives. We didn't go start just digging in back then. And we have jobs and families. And
now, believe me, I was wanting season 3 to come out really bad.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, but
so, I mean, I don't have any problem saying I was duped in any way by it. I mean, cause that's what we knew at the time. That's how everybody was introduced to this. And for people to say that, you know, convicting a murderer, it was nothing new, bullshit. There was plenty of, you saw how they edited it. Even if you knew that he was an asshole, you know, but they certainly, it was just a character assassination. Well, that's important though. But we got into real evidence in that documentary, and we're not some, you know, shields for the Daily Wire or Candace Owens or even, you know, Brenda for that matter, or, you know, Sean. I mean, we just got involved like everybody else and did a podcast, and it kind of blew up, and we just kept talking about it.
And some of us took it a little next level.
Yeah.
And you know,
I mean, I promise you, I had a family and jobs, and I'm an intelligent person too. But I mean, I'm going to quote Andy by saying, if it can happen to me, it can happen to you.
No,
before I knew it, I was so far down in the rabbit hole that I lost all sense of ration. I mean, it was just like rationale. And it does feel like I was an idiot and that I was blind and that I was duped and that I can't even hold making a murder entirely responsible. I mean, it was the catalyst decision.
Yeah, sure.
And so, yeah, my bad.
Have you met, Strang or Buting?
I have not. I have had many interactions with, Jerry via Twitter, but I have not met them, and I was not that person either that was going to go to like their tours and things like that. In fact, kind of thought that was kind of tactless to do like tours regarding it. I had an issue with that, but I've had many interactions with him online. I've talked to pretty much every major player in some capacity, but I have yet to send him a message stating that I flip sides. So,
oh Lord,
nice.
Yeah, there you go.
But right. Or Kathleen, honestly, for that matter. But I'm sure the buzz has been going around for a while, and the fact that I haven't spoken to her in like, I don't know, 4 years probably was a tip off. Maybe, I don't know. But yeah, I got too far involved. Boys and girls, the next time you watch a documentary, don't take it at face value before you let your heart get, you know, involved in it. Start looking up the information first. And then if you need to get involved, then that's your prerogative, I guess. But make sure you're looking at all of the information, and allow yourself some grace if you're wrong.
Absolutely.
That's a good
way to put it.
Yep.
Well, listen, Christine, I really appreciate you coming on. I'm thrilled to hear from you and listen to your story. It's pretty fascinating, and I think it's important that you can, you know, like you said, go that deep in the rabbit hole and then kind of be pulled back by reality in some way. That's a pretty powerful statement. So I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Anything else before we get out of here?
I feel good. I feel really good about this.
Yeah. I think I really, really, really enjoyed it. I wanted to hear your story, and I'm glad you reached out, because we're getting so many comments. I want to hear that perspective from somebody that, you know, we were the same way, just not as dug in as you, obviously, but you know, people that are so dug in and, you know, how you saw the light, you know, how you went from, you know, being that dug in the trenches on that side of the fence to now you're over here. And
when you build a light switch, I guess that's one thing I want people to know. It wasn't like I was just like, one day they're innocent, the next day they're guilty.
Sure.
It was a phase. It was like, it went in phases, and it was a progression. I'm probably still in the progression. Honestly, there's a lot of things regarding Brendan that I have a hard time letting go of.
Same.
Just recently, honestly, I have started thinking that not only was he manipulated by Steven to do some of the things he did, but he may have been exhilarated by it a little bit too. And I have to acknowledge that that's a possibility. And that's
right.
That's kind of where my phase is right now, is that, you know, there are some actions and things that he has said that suggest that there was some disregard for Teresa. That, yeah, you know, you don't want to hear a kid say I raped a woman, because I wanted to know what it felt like.
Yeah, that's, yeah. It's...
But, and you know, and some of the things that he said that weren't true, that seemed just very violent and off the, you know, off the wall. Were those things he was saying to deflect from the truth, or were those things he was saying because it was part of maybe his fantasy over what happened? You know, I mean, it's there. My brain continually progresses and goes back and forth on a lot of issues. And I've had to just acknowledge that I'm probably never going to know. So yeah,
We said that last week. We'll never, ever know the complete detail. You know, here's what exactly happened that day. Never going to happen. So might as well just accept that. And, yep. People continue to argue about it. That's just the way it is.
Well, it was great to meet with you guys. As soon as I saw your podcast with Brenda, I mean, I've had a couple of other people ask if I'd be interested in doing one. And I just wanted to be comfortable with talking to who I was talking to and have that place to send people. So,
yeah. Yes. I'm flattered, honored.
Yeah, really, I am. I really appreciate it. You know, we just tried to come on here and have a fair debate, and, you know, we're getting called every name in the book, but that's fine. We know who we are. We know we believe in to some degree, but we're just discussing it, and minds could be changed. We're open to other everything, and as opposed to the people who are shouting us down. So, really appreciate you coming on.
All righty, sounds good, guys. I'm gonna
get
going. Check on my kid.
Yeah, take
care. All righty, thank you. Have a good one.
Thank you, dear.